That's improv, bitch. Improv, bitch.
I mean, after all, you're nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Hi, I'm Jimmy Corain, your host of Improv Nerd. Joe Bill and Mark Sutton are known as Bassprov, touring the country performing this hugely popular two-man improv show. In this live episode, we talk to these two founding members of the Annoyance Theater, how crazy the parties were, how they stay relevant at their age, and how they developed their characters for Bassprov.
Hey man,
this is like Carson. Who was going to get the chair closest to Jimmy?
Well, he's taller, so we'll go
okay.
down.
That's right. We've known each other for like how long? Did we were saying
25 years?
There you go.
We were just like we were all in our 20s, right?
Yeah.
We were very young and skinny and full of hair back then.
Right. Let's start with you, Joe.
Sure.
Okay. You gave up a state high school basketball ring,
I
right?
Sure did.
To pursue acting. Now, how do you make a decision of doing something that's so cool, acting, versus, I mean, something, well, I guess acting wasn't cool,
yeah.
sports that are so cool
right.
versus acting? How would you make that decision in high school?
Well, the joke is I chose to get applause without running wind sprints.
Uh-huh.
If I'd known that we were going to win a state championship ring, then my decision might have been different. But the story was I had been cast in Brigadoon, and I wanted to get out of basketball practice a half an hour early for 3 weeks so I could make it to rehearsal. And the basketball coach is, you need to make a decision. And so I made the decision and completely broke my father's heart. And they went on to win the state championship in Indiana in 1980. Was anybody born during then? but then we didn't take Brigadoon. We took Diary of Anne Frank to the state thespian conference, as well as our sketch and comedy group. And
well, that's a good combination.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And we almost there was almost some shit at the state thespian festival because the cast of Pippin was really all full of themselves.
Uh-huh.
And the dude playing Pippin was like, he like had his Pippin Jethro Tull boots on, uh-huh. like he was walking around and stuff, and we all had to crash in a gym.
Mm-hmm.
So, and our cast were very physically sort of mature. We had an all-state football player was Mr. Frank.
Uh-huh.
And so there was almost a rumble between Diary of Anne Frank and the cast of Pippin in the Connersville High School gym, but we all thought better of it. But I was named the Indiana All-Star cast and was named the top actor in the state that year. So that was my redemption, which my father did not give a shit about.
Now I call you Howard. Do mm-hmm. people still call you Howard?
You can count them on one hand.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
That came from when I went to college to be a sports journalist.
Uh-huh.
That was my major, broadcast journalism. And I wanted to be a sports journalist, so the guys on my dorm floor started calling me Howard, because, you know, in college everybody's got a nickname. So everybody called me Howard for Howard Cosell, because I worked at the sports radio station and all that. And then, so that started my freshman year of college.
At Indiana, where
right.
you both
mm-hmm.
guys
yep.
went.
Mm-hmm. And then my sophomore year of college, a strange new little student moved into the dorm, the lounge at the end of the dorm floor, and that person ended up being McNapier. And so when he was introduced to me as Howard, he thought that was my name. So then we became friends, and he always called me Howard, and he would introduce me as Howard to people, and it just became a thing. And there's still people out there who think my name is Howard. It has nothing to do with my name at all. Professionally, as an actor in SAG, my name is Mark Howard Sutton, because there was already a Mark Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, in SAG, you can't take somebody else's name if they already have it. So I couldn't be Mark Sutton in SAG, so I went with Mark Howard Sutton.
And so how did you get, in Indiana, introduced to improvisation or sketch?
Well, Mick was a theater major,
uh-huh.
so I started hanging out with the weird theater people.
Okay.
And for a while, Mick was my roommate. And
what was that like?
It's interesting. Yeah. It was
interesting. Do you have any memories of that?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, I like to say that I've known Mick so long, and Joe, too. Mm-hmm. We knew him when he neither drank nor smoked.
Okay.
And he went through the whole smoking alcoholic phase, and now he's back to not drinking or smoking. So we watched him come full circle. But he was a theater guy, and he was friends with a guy named Dave McNerland, who was also a theater guy. And they decided to start their own comedy group, and they had auditions. And Joe got cast in the group. And then they performed for like a year. You guys performed for a year.
Yep.
And Mick was always bugging me, you know, to join the group, but I never wanted it. I was like, it's bullshit. I'm not going to do that. I got to go call a basketball game, you know, or whatever. And so then one week, they had a standing gig at a bar. And one weekend, Joe and like half the group were doing the Fantastics out of town for a fundraiser. Yeah. And so it was just Mick and two other people they had to put on the show because it was a regular gig. And they're like, just sit in for 1 week. And I sat in for a week, and it went really well, and I kind of liked it. And then when we came back next year for my last year of school, I was in the group. So I replaced another Chicago improv guy, Mark Henderson.
Okay.
He was in the original group.
What kind of stuff did Double Take do?
We did sketch and improv, and we wanted to turn over the show.
We tried to do a different show every week while going to school.
So we would do. Like two-thirds sketch and one-third improv, maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. And we all kind of had like our strong improv games that we all preferred, and we kind of...
Short-form stuff.
Short-form stuff. We stacked it towards that. There was another guy who was also... there's a couple of other people that were Annoyance co-founders were in that group, but, you know, the thing of it was, like, we rehearsed after midnight. Uh-huh. We usually have, like, two or three rehearsals from, like, 12 to 3 in the morning. And it was like, oh man, like really cranky shit went on. And
but it was like boot camp.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, it was like boot camp. And I think that you know, part of the Annoyance philosophy of like taking care of yourself, uh-huh. I believe, came from us in college. Like Mick, and, well, half of us had no patience for anybody who brought their own shit into rehearsal because we had to get stuff done. But it was. Yeah, I mean, it was the best of times. It was the worst.
So, what was your impression of Joe? Because you knew him right when you guys were in college. What was your first impression?
Well, Joe and I bonded early because we were the only two people in the improv group that had any interest in sports whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So there was five guys in the group. Mm-hmm. Five guys in the group. Joe and I and three other guys, and two of the other three guys turned out to be gay, and one was bi. Mm-hmm. Right? So basically it was just Joe and I, and they had no interest in sports. Not that you can't be gay and like sports. Mm-hmm. But they didn't. In fact, they had a loathing of it.
Emphatically
and
hated
so,
sports.
You know, Joe and I were the ones who would sit around and talk about IU basketball, mm-hmm. you know, in between scenes or whatever.
We had a sketch that we had, like a sports sketch.
Yeah.
That was... My like the running bit was the new logo for the Indiana University football helmet should just be a decal of a basketball. And it got laughs every week, and everybody knew what was coming.
When Joe was in college, he had a full on head of curly red hair,
like think like Lionel
right.
Richie.
And when we were at IU, the center for our basketball team was a German fellow named Uwe Blopp, who bore a striking resemblance to Joe. So Joe always got to play Uwe in all the sketches.
It's true.
Now, we worked together at the Annoyance almost 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And the theater at that time, I don't know if people remember this, but we got success really early. Remember with Coed Prison Sluts, Manton, the musical Coed Prison Sluts. Mm-hmm. And there was national, certainly, attention. The critics loved us. What was the most surreal moment for you, Mark? I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah.
Is there a moment?
Absolutely. The most surreal moment for me, we were doing... The ladies of the Annoyance were doing a show called the Miss Vagina Pageant. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of on the heels of the real-life Brady Bunch. So it was a lot of the girls from the Brady Bunch. Susan Messing and...
Kate Flannery was on the office.
Oh, that's all.
And they had been scouted by Saturday Night Live. For the show, so they asked us to do a special Wednesday midnight show. You remember this?
Yeah.
Of the Miss Vagina Pageant.
I worked Lauren the VIP
Michaels.
Booth.
Yeah. They asked us to do a special Wednesday midnight show so Lauren Michaels could come see it himself. He wanted to see it with his own eyes. And it had to be Wednesday at midnight because he was helping produce Paul Simon's concert in Central Park. And he had to come fly in, and they had to come, right? And I'm standing outside the theater with Dave Rozowski, and it's approaching midnight. We're waiting. The place is packed. And it was also during the time they were filming League of Their Own in Chicago. So Joan Cusack was in the audience. John Lovitz was in the audience. And remember John Lovitz? He came, and everybody's like, John Lovitz is here. This is so awesome. And then he kept coming to the point where people would go, God damn, Lovitz is here.
He like, crashed at the theater for
weird.
Like 10 days.
It was weird. But anyway, so I'm waiting, and I'm working the front. And I mean, it's our little bullshit 125-seat theater.
And it was a pit. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It was terrible.
It was in the basement, yeah, the whole thing. And I'm waiting and waiting and waiting, and all of a sudden a stretch limo pulls up at right before midnight, and I'm holding the door open, and out comes Lorne Michaels walking into our crap hole theater, and right behind him is Quincy Jones, right? Because Quincy decided to come with him, right? And I just remember Rozowski's kind of standing there like this, and he walked in, and I'm like, Mr. Michaels, and then Quincy Jones went by, and I just, for some reason, I just went, cute. And Quincy Jones goes, what's up? That was the most surreal moment.
And then there was the VIP booth, which was for those guys, which was a restaurant, like half of a booth that was torn out of a restaurant that was up against the lighting booth, but it had a standard with a rope in front of it, and then like me standing by it. So rather than like step aside and let him in, like I took the rope and, you know, right this way, and then I put the rope back in front of him. And, you know, I was like big time. It was like, that was weird. It was very weird.
Now, you said that you describe your annoyance experience as wonderful and awful.
Yeah.
What was awful about it?
I think it was awful for me personally because you know, we were kind of anarchistic, but we weren't into being anarchistic. It's like the annoyance was unique because anybody was allowed to have any kind of bullshit backstory that was just awful that was there. And as long as you were a nice person, I think was the criteria.
Yeah, that's how you got cast in a show.
Yeah, if you're a nice person, then you can be in a show.
Yeah.
And if you can't sing, then you can be the lead in the musical.
Or direct. Eventually,
yeah,
you have to direct.
And so I think for me the like the awful time was just like it was in a way it was one of my low points, just in terms of like crashing and burning and just being irresponsible. And I mean, Jesus, the drugs and the crazy.
Now
shit.
Here's I want to ask you this, because I for the annoyance standards, I was a prude. I didn't drink, I wasn't involved in sex, not until the last couple of years. But they have these parties. They have the closing night party. I remember Manson, and then they'd be legendary. They'd say, "Oh, can you believe what happened?" What, honestly, and we don't have to say names, but for my sake, what was the weirdest thing that went on in that building? I mean, Mick lived. People don't understand. Mick lived upstairs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were all there almost 24/7.
Well, there was an entire A-frame house that sat on the roof of the building.
It was like a ski lodge.
A ski lodge dropped on top of
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With acid and three ways and the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I would say the craziest thing that I can remember.
You got one.
It didn't happen to me. Okay. But one of our actors, who I will not name, on the opening night of Coed Prison Sluts, ended up on a couch with two actresses on either side eventually, and ended up, by the time the night was over, had sex with both of them on either end of the couch while the other one was on the other end of the couch.
Oh, yeah.
That was that was interesting.
What was yours? Because you have one. Your face got all blushed. And
No, I have 10.
Well, give me one like, juicy one for the podcast.
Like juicy sex or juicy drugs?
I don't...
So there was... well, the drug one was easy. There was... we were doing... I think it was the closing night of the Chiggers, Mamas and Reunion Tour, which was... so it was kind of a parody of the
Judds.
The Judds,
yeah.
Right? And so we thought it would be a good idea to drop acid right before we went on stage, because I was in the band. I played like harmonica and jaw harp.
The show,
yeah. Mark was the director.
I didn't watch
so
it from the back.
So and you knew this story, right?
I do now.
Okay, yeah. So there's like three of us that were all going to drop acid, and it's like, and we're like waiting till like a minute. We're like, you know, we got 2 minutes, and then it's like we waited 1 minute, and then we all dropped acid. And then it was like, and then the next thing you know, somebody comes up, and they're like, we're holding for like 20.
Oh, you know why? And I know why. What? Because Lily Tomlin was coming to the show.
Are you...
Yes. Lily Tomlin was coming to the show. She wasn't there yet.
Yeah, so it was boy, that was a ride.
All right, the sex one.
There were sex that happened during shows.
You're kidding me.
No, well, there was a show called Sex Boy that was famous.
We were both in it, Howard and I, but that was a midnight show. There was no sex going on involved in that one.
There was. There was sex. There was. I know for a fact that there were many times that sex happened backstage during Sex Boy with people in the cast while they were waiting to go on the next time.
Yeah.
And
did you know that? It was like an hour show.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. It was in that context. It's like method acting.
My favorite one, and I shared it when Mick was here, and it was you and Ed for him, and we were doing Coed Prison Sluts, and I was, and you used to like to drink during the shows.
I have had a couple of beers before a show.
Okay, well, this night you decided to you were drinking a pint of Jack Daniels, and you and Eddie were going back
and
forth.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, when you do that, the show just gets longer and longer and longer. And Mick had walked through the theater, and he had seen him. And the next night, we got this note. From now on, there's going to be no more hard drinking, only beer. Remember that one?
I do remember.
That was a great note.
And that was it. And from that point on, it was only beer.
Yeah.
Only beer backstage. It was oppressive.
Now, Howard, you were in the real-life Brady Bunch.
Mm-hmm.
You were Mr. Brady.
That was Mike Brady.
You played opposite Jane Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like working with Jane?
Jane's great, you know. She was. I wasn't the original Mr. Brady.
Who was?
They
had
asked me to be They had asked me to be Mr. Brady in the beginning, and I had a conflict on when the show began, and I couldn't do it. So the first we would do a couple weeks with each episode. So the first two episodes, so the first 4 weeks of the show, was Richard Label, who's another veteran improviser, and then he told them that he would only do a month. And we didn't think the show was going to last a month. We had no idea. And then he left the show, and then I came in because my conflict had stopped. So I did it for the 13 months after that. But Jane, great. She, you know, super professional, really fun. And just, you know, some people are just easy to work with because when you show up, they are prepared. You know, they know their shit. You don't have to hold their hand. They're ready. They know exactly what they're supposed to do, when they're supposed to do it, and that was Jane. Still is.
And she used to sing Go Ask Alice at the end of the show and just, like, killed it. Like, she sang it better than Grace Slick. Did Grace Slick sing that originally?
Yes.
And a good kisser. We had to kiss as Mr. and Mrs. Brady. Jane was a good kisser.
Well, then you weren't doing it, right?
And then later, well, we had the opposite going on.
Oh, right.
Because in the real Brady Bunch, the guy who played Mike Brady was gay. And Florence Henderson was not, and then in our Brady Bunch, the woman who played Florence Henderson's gay, and I wasn't. So it was a mirror image of the TV show.
And then the show goes to New York, and it gets cast. Andy Richter then gets Mike Brady, and you stay back to run the day to day operation.
Mm-hmm.
How was it to make that decision at that time?
You know, it wasn't hard for a couple reasons. One, I had been doing the Brady Bunch for 13 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do two shows a week every Tuesday, 13 months. And as tempting as it was to go to New York, they were going to go there and do 8 shows a week. And I was at that point where, you know, I was still in my 20s and I was still learning, you know, I was still learning about being on stage. I was learning about comedy. I was learning about all that stuff. And it was like, okay, I could go and have this experience and live in New York for a few months and all that. But what is it going to do for me? You know, I'd be faking somebody else's role that they created 8 times a week in a sitcom parody. Or I could stay back in Chicago and continue to do different kinds of shows. And what ended up happening was, because we lost so many people, I started filling in other shows. So for a time, I was doing 11 shows a week, but they were all different. You know, I was doing musical one night and you know, comedy the next, and, you know, basically we did a three-man show. Yeah. I filled in for Andy. We just kind of swapped, and you and I were doing
Ayn Rand gives me a boner.
And improv and sketch and all that. So I really, in that time, grew a lot as a performer because I had to. I had to learn about playing all these different styles of comedy with different directors and different people, and it really changed me as a performer.
And I don't think people realize when we were doing that. I mean, there'd be nights where you could do 3 or 4 shows a night,
mm-hmm. yeah.
to a packed house.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, it was a great learning experience. And it's funny because when I started at The Annoyant, you were kind of in and out, Joe. You were doing some stand up.
Yeah, I did stand up, and that took me out of a couple of the early plays, but then like people got cast. I had to step out of Co-Ed Prison Sluts originally, and Bob Fisher went in, actually because I was working Shubas and doing stand-up, and then Bob Fisher got cast as soon as that opened at Second City, and I took over Henry. But yeah, I did stand-up, but that was like, that ended like in 93 when I ended out at the Improv, and they said, Bud wants you to come to the Melrose Club, because I did a great set at Santa Monica, and then they said, we want you to do this bit, and this bit. And it was like, I was doing a Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill thing that was killer. And they're like, we want you to do Men and Women and Bathrooms and Torturing Your Cat with Yogurt, like all this bullshit hack stuff. I'm like, no, I want to do Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill. Women don't want to be treated like equals. Men treat each other like shit. You know, and they're like, no, that's not how comedy works. I'm like, well, I got a theater I got to go back to. So
now you said that stand up helped you become a better improviser, and
yeah.
it also helped you avoid therapy.
Yes,
is that still true today?
Yeah. Well, I mean that was I did that. Stand up was a good replacement for therapy. I've been through plenty of therapy. I think that's why you and I bond so
right.
well. And it's
what's your biggest issue? You think?
I think I had a false savior complex is what I told the first time I sat down with a shrink. I told him my shrinks are bullshit, and shrinks are shrinks because they can't fix themselves, so they just fix other people to make themselves feel better. And this whole freaking monologue, and I said, I know what's wrong with me. I got a savior complex. I find women that are broken and damaged, and I just want to save them. And he's like, is that what you think you have? I'm like, I know I have it. He goes, you don't have a savior complex. You have a false savior complex. I went, what's that? You get with women that you know you can't fix so that you know you can fail at something again. And I went, you got a room next week?
Mark, do you think that's true about Joe?
What? That he has a false...
Yeah.
I think I'm through that, though. I don't...
What do you think? What do you think his biggest issue is?
Joe's biggest issue?
Yes.
He's too humble.
Is that real?
No, really.
No, Joe. Being Joe's friend for that long, I think Joe's biggest issue is he seeks advice and then doesn't take it.
Great. And what's Howard's biggest issue?
I think we've evolved out of it, but like I think Howard's more of a romantic than me. And what's the Peter Pan syndrome that you used to talk about? It's Mark, when we do basketball, like Mark has done like poetry and like brought the fucking room, like here's this hillbilly fish, and he starts busting out some poetry, and people are like, oh, and it always would fucking piss me off because I hate poetry, unless it's like Bukowski or something gross.
Right.
But Mark's just kind of like a romantic, and so I think this is all, let me just say, I think this is like pre our 40s.
Because okay.
I think we've kind of mellowed into like...
Yeah, a little bit.
Like reasonableness, a little bit. Or like since we've had kids.
It's about time.
I know. But I think that's it. It's like Mark, I think Mark likes being Peter Pan to all the children.
Okay. Let's talk about Bass Prop, because we're going to do a little of it.
Yeah.
It's a fishing scene.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys fish in real life? How did the show come about?
You're better at this.
We used to do a show, as you know, called The Screw Puppies.
Okay.
And so at the end of the week, the last show of the week at The Annoyance, late night Saturday, was called The Screw Puppies. And it was subtitled Rabid Vicious Improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife loves to talk about it because she used to live near the theater before we met each other. And the poster for The Screw Puppies was a wiener dog in a circle. It was sniffing its own ass. And she hated that poster. And she thought, who the hell would do a show like that? And then she ended up finding out it was me. But it was kind of a no-holds-barred improv thing. Joe put it together, and what we would do, we'd go across the street and get a case and a half of beer from the bar across the street. We'd have the beer backstage, and the only promise of the show, you know, like now you go to a show and it's like, oh, we're going to change the rules of improv and break boundaries. The promise of the Screw Puppies was, we are going to be as funny as we can till the beer runs out. And when the beer runs out, the show's over. And sometimes that would be 55 minutes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it would be 45 minutes. You know, you never
did. Because I heard at that point you would drop acid.
Some people did. Like you, Jimmy.
Not for Screw Puppies.
So in Screw Puppies, one time, Joe and I... And Screw Puppies was an improv show, but it looked like a sketch show. If you didn't know it was improvised, you might think it was sketch, because instead of editing like improvisers do, somebody would be in the light booth, and the lights would go out at the end of the scene, and then a new scene would start, so it looked like sketch. And one time the lights came up and Joe and I were sitting in chairs kind of like this, and we just started to pretend to fish and play these guys, and we were out there for a while, and then when the lights went out and we came backstage, people were like, what the fuck was that, right? And so we knew instantly that we had to do it again. And so a couple weeks later we did it again, and then we did it again a couple weeks later, and we started to be like, wow, this is interesting. So then the annoyance closed. And we decided to create a show around these guys. And that's kind of how it worked.
Improv.
How you doing, everybody? Hello, there's Donnie Weaver. This here's our buddy Carl, and we're going to recreate a fishing trip for you that we took this morning down in Manmore County, Indiana. In order to do that, I'd like to take a suggestion of just anything that's in the news that you find troubling or anything that's weighing heavy on you.
G8 Summit.
What is that?
G8 Summit.
The G8 Summit. Okay.
And I would like something that you stick your finger into.
Excellent. So, ladies and gentlemen, this here will be the G8 Summit Peanut Butter Fishing Trip. Enjoy. Other one. Oh, that's fine.
You got can't take any of that stuff to school anymore. Because all the allergies. Right?
Allergies.
You can't take peanut butter. You can't take nuts of any kind. Nope. You can't take anything made with nut oil.
Yep.
Everybody's so sensitive.
Yeah.
And do you know that when they do a project at school with, let's say they want to make cookies, right? The teacher has to send a photocopy of all the ingredients they're using home, and you have to check it and sign off on it. And if you don't, your kid can't do the project.
That's wrong. That's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
How are you going to know if you're allergic until you're exposed?
Nope.
That's it.
I think they should have a test when you go right into school. They should have like peanuts and all the stuff kids are allergic to. And the first day of school, you test it right there, right? And then if your face blows up or something, or you swallow your tongue, they mark it off that you're allergic.
And they give you a special seat.
Yeah,
sure.
In the back of the classroom.
Yep. Sure. Or the cafeteria. That's where the problems are.
Yeah.
Or they should just build in like some type of tolerance program where whatever you're allergic to, you have to eat just a little bit every day until you fucking beat the dragon.
What does that mean, beat the dragon?
Well, because a dragon is something that we create in our own mind that's impossible to defeat. And right. So because we've turned into a country of pussies, as soon as a problem arrives, we just say, I can't beat that dragon. No, I need a special seat in case somebody fucking throws a peanut at me.
It's the people who make milk and the people who make pills. It's their fault.
Yep. Dairy and pharmaceuticals right there. You know, I was at the high school the other day. Mm-hmm. You know, these women, I call them women, but these girls, they have the biggest breasts now. I tell you what, because of the milk. There's hormones in those milk that are breast-inducing.
Yep.
In the milk?
In the milk.
Dairy
products.
What are you talking about?
They want to make the cows bigger.
Yeah.
To produce more milk.
Yeah.
So you drink the milk, you're getting the cows.
Yeah. That makes the high school girls'
boobs. Yeah.
I thought it was music video.
No.
Or you? I thought it was like bad role models. No. That's what happened to my daughter. She had Madonna. My daughter grew up with Madonna. She's 23 now, but like the first time I saw her walk out of her bedroom with black comb tits, I thought, more music videos for you.
I'll tell you what's even worse is that iPod.
iPod or iPad?
Both of them.
Why are they bad?
Well, because first of all, you put them in your ears, it screws up your brain waves.
Yeah, you turn it up too loud.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just turn it down.
They got a pill for that.
Do they?
They got a pill for everything. They got pills for shit they don't even know what it is yet.
Yeah.
They make the pill, and then they invent something that you might have so they can sell you the pill.
That's right.
Yep. So...
Yeah, it's all decided by a small cabal of people who meet and decide how they can best serve your pharmaceuticals. You know, that small group of people that distributes bullshit to us because we're ignorant and we will consume it.
That's right.
It's true.
That's what it's about.
Let me ask you that. You've been orderly at the hospital for what, 25 years?
25 years. I'm going to retire next year.
There you go. Up until 2 years ago, did anybody ever come into the hospital with restless leg syndrome?
Never.
Never. It didn't exist.
Yeah, can you believe that?
How about this one? Chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah, chronic fatigue. Bullshit. And the people who get that are the people who don't really even work.
Yeah. We call that, in our day, we just call that lazy.
It's like or take a nap.
Yeah.
Take a nap.
Yeah.
I'm chronically fatigued. Well, take a nap.
That's a good one. See, now that's practical. But you know what? They don't want us to think like that.
No.
Because no one's going to make money off practicality, are they?
Exactly right.
Or naps.
That's exactly right.
I'll tell you something. If a pharmaceutical company could make a pill to make you tired to take a nap, then
they would follow that up by manufacturing a nap booth that you could blow up, and then you'd have to buy a nap booth, and that would have to be FDA regulated because they'd get a kickback. You take a pill to take a nap that the pharmaceutical company paid for you, then you'd have to pay for the thing that you took your nap on, and then your employer would get to write off your lack of productivity for that day to banks who are going to fucking jack up the interest rate on that shit anyway, and next thing you know, you're sleeping through your job and you get fired. But that's what they want. They want people unemployed and dumb. I'll tell you what, when the market crashed in 2009, bar business was fine. Well, they wouldn't buy scotch or anything. You'd have to put, you know, more Pabst Blue Ribbon on the tank, but the bar business, you know, that's what they want. When people are down, they go to bars. They go to churches, and then they go to bars. That's all America is.
I haven't seen you at church drink.
Who, me?
Yeah.
I have a differing relationship with the Lord.
As of when, you used to sing in the chorus. You used to pass out the baskets for the collection.
Yeah, I'm changing my whole outlook. I'm becoming more spiritual and less religious.
Oh, that sounds good.
As I get older, you know,
sounds good.
Like I still believe in God, but anything that's organized by man just kind of leaves me with a sour taste in my mouth.
Did something happen?
Hmm?
Did something happen?
Nah, not really. You know. Well. Look.
There's a duck pat.
You remember my ex-wife, Irene?
Oh, yeah? I couldn't stand her.
I was going to say, yeah. you acted like there was something wrong with her.
Well, I wanted to say, I'm going to say this right now. I hooked up with her once.
When we were married?
Yeah. I knew there was problems.
Okay.
You said you were drawing up the papers and stuff. No, but I thought you were
wrong. Why would you tell him that on his boat?
Because you said this was a safe place.
It's a safe place. But I mean, why bring that whore up again? That's all I mean. We're out here on the boat. Donnie brings us out. It's like, I mean, there's some shit. That. You don't have to talk about exactly, you know, everything.
Just
you know,
come right
it's
out.
It's not like the Dr. Sill show. There's like Maury's it. Not you here with a fraternity test or anything. He won't fucking weather you. Probably just complicated. He should actually probably thank you because that shit wasn't going to work anyway. But I'm just saying, decorum would dictate you probably wouldn't bring that up in his boat.
Anyway, that's all in the past. Anyway, after you, she moved on to the Reverend Huffhand.
You're kidding me.
So I didn't feel comfortable having him up there telling me about how I should act, knowing how he was acting.
He's a hypocrite, is what he is. See, if he was sitting in this boat right now, he wouldn't say what I just said to you.
No.
He would give you some, it's about integrity or honesty. It's between a man and a woman.
Sure. He's a liar.
Yeah.
That's what they do. They give you headlines that don't really mean anything. That's what the religion does. That's why I'm Unitarian. You go there and you might read something from Abraham Lincoln or from a Star Trek script. Because you know what? There's God in everything.
The drum circle. Yeah, I mean, drum circle.
Yeah, you have a drum circle. Yeah. You know, you can read the directions off the back of a bag of marshmallows for how to make s'mores. And it's a metaphor for something.
Because I like to think there's a higher power in everything. You know, like right here. Why can't this be church? Somewhere, this is church.
Sure. I like to go somewhere where someone tells me what to do. Oh. There's too much freedom here. See, this isn't what God had in mind for us.
How do you know? Where'd you read that?
That's in the Bible.
Who wrote the Bible?
Jesus.
No.
Who did that?
No, sir. Well, first of all, there's the Old Testament, which is all the Dungeons and Dragons shit. Then there's the New Testament, which starts off by the four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the closest in to Jesus' death that one of those guys was, like 60 years later. It's all hearsay.
I thought Jesus wrote the whole thing.
No.
Really?
He was reported on.
I had heard that he could not even write.
I heard he caught a mean fish, though, and could build like a doghouse.
Oh, he was talented.
And a great example of love. I mean, Jesus, I mean, he was the example of love. Don't get me wrong. Like, I love Jesus. It's just Christians that drive me fucking crazy.
Well, I'm a Christian.
Are you?
Yeah.
Well, then, are you scared? Or do you love God? Or are you afraid of God? Are you God-fearing or you God-loving?
I'm afraid of God.
Well, then what a horrible existence.
How am I ever going to get to heaven if I'm not afraid of God?
Well, what's heaven to you?
Heaven, it's nice, a beautiful lawn and a buffet and all sorts of nice stuff.
Well, that's crazy. Doesn't that sound like a story like a human would invent?
That's what it says in the Bible.
Who wrote the Bible?
Jesus, I told you, Jesus Christ did.
He didn't write the Bible. If it weren't for St. Paul, the Bible... What?
I'm pretty sure the word buffet is not in the Bible.
They didn't say buffet. That's something that's been new in the last 20 or 30 years. They said a lavish feast of beautiful food and eats.
So you just interpreted that to mean buffet, which is part of the problem, see?
Like more loaves and fishes.
See, you took one thing and interpreted it to be something else, which is part of the problem with religion.
That's right.
Because the Bible might say one thing, and you might interpret it as something else, and then you tell that to a room full of people, and they walk out interpreting it as something else, and pretty soon, you know, you got...
It's like 20 different interpretations for the same thing. That's why Catholics and Protestants and Greek Orthodox, like, nobody can get along. It's like, what about the one guy that was about love and hanging with whores and lepers? What about that?
Well, that shouldn't have even been in the book.
Why not?
Because he's just a sinner. That's a bad example when people read that.
He was compassionate.
Oh, I thought he was talking about L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh.
I thought he was talking about L. Ron Hubbard. Whores.
No. L. Ron Hubbard was a copycat.
Yeah, but he loved whores.
Well, where do you guys get all this information?
The fucking internet. Aren't you online?
I was online for a while, and then I had to put one of those net nannies on there.
A net nanny?
You live by yourself.
That doesn't.
Are you trying to restrict yourself for content?
Yes.
That you yourself don't want to.
I don't know. Yes.
Because you know you have sin inside you?
That's exactly
right.
That's
Romans. You can read that exact chapter of Romans, and St. Paul wrote that.
I know that was Romans.
Yeah, if it
wasn't. Jesus wrote that.
No, St. Paul wrote that. St. Paul was like the Karl Rove of the day.
Every time I bring something up, you want to pull down your Karl Rove and Jesus.
Or James Carville, whoever. He was the publicist. He was the hype guy.
There was no publicist back then.
There was. St. Paul would go to the churches and he'd say, "You guys got to knock this shit out," in so many words. And it's like, listen, Corinthians, knock this shit out. Here's the rules. And then he off we go to Rome, you know, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, they're fucking around back in Corinth again. I've got to write some letters to Corinthians. Get out of here. Now, I'm going back to Corinth. You Romans mind your shit. And so he works. And off we go to Corinth. Oh, man, you won't believe what the Romans are doing, Paul. I'm going to write more letters to fucking Romans. That's what makes up most of the Bible.
Why do you have to do this?
Do what?
Do this. It's the Bible and Jesus. They're beautiful things.
Jesus is beautiful. The Bible is a wonderful history book. But it's just like it's created so that men can control men. It's a select few people. It's like the G8, right? You got like certain people that all have financial interests tied to each other, right? And they need a flock of sheep that consume their goods.
Is everything a conspiracy theory to you?
It's not a conspiracy if it's real, Carl. I'm just saying.
It could be.
What?
It's not a theory if it's real. It can be real conspiracy.
Well, sure. But yeah, there's conspiracies. Like, why would you move? Why would you move your summit from Chicago to, like, well, you know, where
Camp David.
Camp David. Like, what?
Security reasons.
Security? Really?
Sure.
Like that's kind of, I don't know, that seems like, why don't you just meeting and then like every day you're walking somebody out and here's what we're talking about. Why don't you have a closed circuit TV? Here's what we're talking about. Because you can. Why don't they let us look at them? Why don't they let us look at our political gods? Because they'd be demystified, that's why.
You mean this? You want them to let us watch the summit?
Yeah.
Who the hell would want to watch the G8 summit?
I know certain people in certain corners.
I'm gonna borrow a line from Coach Knight. All right? And I'm paraphrasing now because he wasn't talking about the G8 summit.
All right.
But he was talking about the NBA. I'm going to apply G8 summit. If I had a choice between two stations on the television and one was showing the G8 summit and one was showing two mice fucking, I would watch the mice even if the picture was fuzzy.
Did you paraphrase the mice fucking?
Yeah, because he said NBA.
Why do you always have to say fucking?
Because it's a word.
Mice don't fuck. It's okay. In the Bible.
I would watch the mice make sweet love. Sweet mice love.
I know when you're making fun of me. Dad,
how was that?
That was a lot of fun.
It's fun doing it with you.
It was really, at one point, how was it when, because you guys have done it a lot as two people, how is it when you add a third person? How does the dynamic change?
Well, I mean, it kind of depends on the third person, because it's still that old thing, like you want to take care of your guest.
Right.
So it's usually people that sit in with us are people we know pretty well, and so it's kind of like, what do we need to do to take care of them? But then sometimes it's just like, like Tracy Letts played with us, and that's the most prepared guest we've ever had. Like, he was calling out counties in Indiana. Like, he had this whole backstory.
For people who don't know Tracy Letts.
Our Chicago's own Pulitzer Prize award-winning playwright, actor. He's a Steppenwolf guy. Wrote August Osage County, the greatest play you'll ever see. It's amazing. And he also he looks a little bit like me, so he played my brother. But he's just like, he was completely researched. Mm-hmm. We knew he was my brother. He had this whole backstory, and you could tell he maybe spoke to 5 or 10% of it. But I mean, he was just in character, and that was awesome.
We knew that you would love it because it's right up your alley. The patience of
right,
yeah.
You know, it's a very patient, deliberate show that, you know, we're totally fine with playing those silences and stuff in between the laughs and finding out more about the people and all that stuff. So,
because at the end of the day, it's still about fishing. Mm-hmm. So really, all we have to do is fish and not even talk if we don't want to.
I have to say, it was going in and out. You know, I was worried that I wanted to take care of Howard, but you seemed really comfortable with being silent. Mm-hmm. And then for me, it was tough. At times I was really present, and times I pulled out.
Well, there's every once in a while we'll do that thing where we talk over each other. Uh-huh. And so, like, when we went into that, like, I almost backed off of that because it's like, oh, Jimmy might know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's, yeah, I kind of just defaulted to, like, you know,
right,
whatever, we're going to.
But it's also not unusual. I mean, I've done that in the show before.
Yeah.
You know,
what do you think causes that?
Well, I think it's a couple different things. One time we did the show with Fred Willard, and it's always been a huge hero of mine. So here I am sitting on stage, and there's like 900 people there, and I'm sitting next to Fred Willard, who I used to watch on TV, and the show starts, and there's a stretch of about, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 minutes in the show where I realize all of a sudden that I'm just sitting there watching Fred Willard do my show. And I have to, in the back of my mind, go, what the hell are you doing? You're in this show, right? You can't just sit and watch him. But we also did a show once in Miami, and our Joe's suggestion was mad cow, right? Mad cow disease. It was at the height of all that weird beef thing.
In England.
And Joe chose to interpret that as him having the first signs of being afflicted by mad cow, right? So he's like all over the place, and he's kind of frantic and all this, and we're at a festival, so a lot of people we knew were in the audience, and I'm getting really pissed.
He was pissed
because I couldn't get a word in,
and there was a third suggestion that was Michael Jackson, which is like, we'll try to work it in, and then so I just start like getting possessed with mad cow and ranting about Michael Jackson and singing Michael Jackson song. And I mean, he was Mark Sutton pissed.
And at one point I just shut up, and I'm like, you know what, in my mind I'm like, I don't know what the hell you're trying to do, dude, but do it, right? Because right now you're killing the show. That's what's going on in my head.
But the audience was loving it. The audience loved seeing him not getting it, and they were clicked into it.
And then
it.
A few minutes later...
What was going on with you?
That's just one of those ones where, like, I knew he could handle it, and I knew I had him. So, I mean, part of the annoyance thing is, like, you know, we fuck with each other, but within the construct of theater, you know? And so, like, I knew that I had him, and I was pretty sure he was going to figure it out by the end of it. But, I mean, he was as pissed as I've ever seen him, like, outside of a co-ed theater league softball field.
Right.
He was pissed. And then people got it. I mean, the audience knew what was going on, and you finally clicked in.
Oh, I did. Like 10 minutes before the end of the show.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like, what did you say to him afterwards? Were you pissed?
I started laughing because I'm like, it was a 45-minute set. It took me 35 minutes to get it.
And then when he got it, like, you see him go, oh, and the audience was just like, wah, out of their mind. And then a year later, we're in Seattle where, like, I usually play real liberal and he plays real conservative, and I don't play with my glasses usually. And so we're coming out, and his shirt's all buttoned up. And I'm like, well, you're looking dapper today, you know? He's like, yep, just, you know, feeling like a little dapper thing. I don't have my glasses on. And so we get whatever the suggestions are, and then the lights come up, and I'm, like, doing all my object work shit and getting my lore. That's sort of Paula, and I'm like, throw that. And then all of a sudden I hear this, wah! This, like, laugh. And I'm like, man, I must be doing some pretty good mime here. And I look over, and his shirt's gone. He's got this T-shirt on, but I can't see because... So, like, and I, like, look over, and I thought it was a Comfort Inn and Suites T-shirt, but it was an Obama T-shirt. And all of them out there know that, like, he's the conservative dude, and I'm like, usually liberal. And so, like, he totally fucked me because it's like... And I was like, is that Obama? I'm like, oh, now what do I do? And that was fun because I was on the run the whole show, and then the audience just loved him, you know... holding the little carrot in front of me.
We got a couple minutes. I want to get some questions in from the audience. So if we could turn the lights on real quick, Carrie, and get some real quick questions in for Joe and Mark. Yeah.
If you could control it, would you prefer a slow start or just a zinger right off the bat?
I have no preference.
I think the nature of the show lends itself to patience, but... It's nice to kind of get that early laugh to kind of set the tone and then roll back into it. We did the show once with Mo Collins.
Mm-hmm, from Mad TV.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Mo was like... I described doing the show with Mo as taking a little kid to Disney World and all leading up to the show, like you're getting ready to go to Disney World, and you're saying, you know, we got all day, it's fine, just, you know, just take your time, we got all day, and the kid's going, uh-huh, 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 and then the gates open, and you're chasing the kid around Disney World for 7 hours. That's how it was with Mo. I mean, she took off. That was probably the fastest paced show that we've ever done.
Starting with this is my cousin Gina, and she goes apostrophe Gina.
Other questions?
When you say pace, like, do you mean she was just like ripping out a lot of topics very quickly, or just everything about her energy was just?
Yeah, well, I mean, she does comedic improvisation, and so which is a little different than like playing the truth of the emotion, and it's a little more presentational. And so, you know, why I say I have no preference is like it's our job to do the show that's here tonight, and it's a and if Mo's sitting in the boat, and we know that her background is comedy, then, you know, we got to take care of her.
Yeah.
It was fine, but it's just like you can't go in thinking I want it to be this tonight. You know, we've known each other forever. We could do this show in our sleep. But when something starts, it's always great. Anything's invited. Whatever this is exactly what it's supposed to be. We're gonna be fine.
You mentioned before you did the show here that no matter what happens, you stay in the constraints, you know, of the boat. You can't leave the boat. Does that say that most shows do get pretty, you guys really go at it sometimes?
Yeah, especially when it's a two-person show.
Yeah.
Because we have much more time to do the back and forth. And when we first created the show, it was like, well, maybe we should, you know, like if we're talking about something that happened yesterday, we could pop over to the side and do a scene and come back. And then we're like, no, we don't want to do that. Everybody does that. It's like, we want to sit down in this boat and not get out of it and see what happens. And we had a friend who once told us, he said he liked the show because he's like, in the first 30 seconds, it's like you put your foot in the bear trap. And then you're there. You're there for 45 minutes. And you can't get out until the show's over. And so that's kind of what we wanted to do.
How close are you playing the conservative and you play the liberal? How close is that to you, your views in real life?
Not. I mean, I feel bad for Mark because I think we're both more liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But Mark's really good at articulating the conservative point of view. And he's really good at playing that game that conservatives play that's like this circuitous conversation back to the original point where nothing's really discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And we're both from Indiana, so we can both speak to it. We both, his dad was in the military. My dad fucking lives for Fox News, and it drives me crazy. But the reason I don't go overboard is like, okay, well, then I'm going to learn to imitate your ignorance, Dad. And what he's afraid of. I mean, everything, the whole religion thing is like, it's the fear that's fucking us all up.
So a lot of it is a reaction to your father?
I think it's like, it's just channeling it a little bit. And there's been time, we did the show in Utah one time, and Mark went conservative. I mean, he was like a fucking national hero after the show.
There have been times when I've said things during the show that I thought, this is the most vile, ridiculous thing in the world, and somebody in the back of the house goes, yeah! And I just kind of go, whoa.
Yeah, but it's. I think, you know, if the show goes political, then we both have the taste for, you know, we think that most of America is sort of centrist, and we're liberal about some things and conservatives about other things, and it's the absolutism that's fucking everything up. So I'll try to play a liberal that's like for gun control. And he'll play a conservative that's, you know, all for women's rights.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just play that with integrity and honesty between us without trying to make a placard out of it, mm-hmm. and like make a statement. And that usually works pretty well.
I mean, because if you boil it down to what is the show about, that's what the show's about. The show is about taking these larger issues and showing that they aren't black and white. And how do they affect regular guys? You know, these are just two regular guys. And, you know, everybody gets on their soapbox to talk about this or that. But it's like those things affect people. And they don't affect people in nearly the way that most people assume that they do. So that's kind of what we try to show.
Let me ask you this. When we started The Annoyance, we're in our 20s. We are considered, I mean, I don't think people remember this, but we were eclipsing Second City at that time, back in the 90s. Because Second City had lost its voice.
Yep.
How do we, us in our 40s, still stay relevant in improvisation?
By doing it?
Yeah.
Like, because I think, you know, I think it's just like, for me, it's about going other places in the world now. Like, I love doing shows with Mark, but it's like, you know, we both got kids and we both got jobs, and my I got to perform in Germany with a woman who's like one of the, like, the top. Her name's Patty Stiles, and she's like as good a Keith Johnstone practitioner as you can find, and they're all like story and narrative and whatever. And there's like this really unspoken fucked up war between Del Close people and Keith Johnstone people. So we wanted to do a two-person show just to say, like, how are we alike? Fuck how we're different. And I did this show in Germany, and it was like, you know, we did like a two-person Harold and then some Johnstone stuff, and like there's one breakup scene where like we're crying, and like the Germans are like, oh, look at the emotion. You know, and it was just like, and it was just honest and riveting. And I mean, she played the shit out of it. I mean, I had to play a fucking asshole, and she played the shit out of it. And like, left me, but she took her ring off, and you know, walked out. And she's crying, and I'm crying, and the lights did like a slow burn. I mean, it was like, you know, for me, that's, you know, I'm selfish. I like that. That's my relevance.
How do you stay relevant?
I don't even know if I am relevant.
I've come. Really?
No, I honestly don't. I'm not really. I mean, I still love doing it, and I still have stuff to say. But you know, I got two little kids, and I use my improv skills to make up bedtime stories and hang out with them, and I try to get on stage whenever I can, and I still love doing it. But it's, you know, I go long times between drinks at the well. You know, mm-hmm. The last time I did a real show was a couple of years ago. I did Rush Limbaugh here. And we still do Bass Prov every now and then, but I don't have like a regular gig, and I haven't for a while, so I'm just kind of sorting that out.
And you never took an improv class. Is that still true?
First improv class I was ever in, I was teaching it.
Yeah. So my question to you as a teacher is, how do you pull games and stuff like that for your class?
A lot of it just stuff I make up myself, you know, and it really is acting based. Mm-hmm. My approach has always been that way. I learned to improvise that way by working with Mick and working with Martin and Joe and people like that. And so my approach has always been very acting based. And I just, you know, I have a real love-hate relationship with improv class anyway, because I don't.
And you teach?
Yeah, I teach every week. But I tell my students on the first day usually, I'm not here to teach you improv. I'm here to show you ways for you to find your voice as an artist. That's what I'm here for. So I offer up options that people maybe don't think about on their own to find their voice, because it's art. It's not math. I can't teach you the math of improvisation because everybody's different. And when I hear students who, you know, they don't do this anymore in class because, you know, or on stage because a teacher told them not to do that. It's like, that's bullshit. You know, it's one person's opinion. You know, I always go back to Bull Durham. At the end of Bull Durham, when he's nervous because his dad's in the audience, and Crash Davis's response is, he's as full of shit as anybody else. And that's how I feel as a teacher. I mean, I've been around a long time. I've seen and done thousands of improv scenes. And I'm at the point now where, you know, I've been improvising longer than most of my students have been alive. Right? So that gives me a certain perspective. But by no means do I feel like this is how you should do it. It's like, you got to figure that out on your own. Mm-hmm. You know? And you got to be the artist that you want to be.
So we are going to figure out how to figure it out on our own. I know I'm still a work in progress. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you both so much. Joe
thank
Bill,
you.
Mark
thank
Howard
you.
Sutton for being my guest.
Thank you,
give him a hand.
Just a blast.
Thank you all. And you can see Bass Prov this April's CIS Chicago Improv Festival.
We're actually doing two shows.
Two shows, so check it out. It's the 14th year, and you're still the artistic 15th year, your artistic director.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you guys, the audience, not only here at Second City, but also who listen to the podcast. We're going to have a raffle, so we've got some great prizes. We've got a
nice.
Justin Bieber toothbrush and a Nerf. Just for you guys, because I know you're big basketball
That's
fans.
Awesome. If you want to raffle off the shirt that you wore on this show.
And we'll raffle off this shirt. And if you guys, we're going to be out in front, if you guys could just, I'm sure people have more questions,
sure.
So if you could hang out for a couple minutes, that would be great. I want to thank Carrie on the lights, and I just want to, again, what a wonderful show. All my interns, and if you really like this show, find We're Improv Nerd. Go to our Facebook page and please, please, please like us. We're at like 900 fans. It's so helpful to my self-esteem. I'm on less.
When you get across that thousand,
I can hardly wait. So tell your friends, like us. It's Improv Nerd. If you want to study with me, go to jimmycarain.com. I've got a couple artist low comedy classes coming up. And thank you so much for joining us. And remember, as always, walk, don't run. Thank you. Great day. Well, there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd. I want to thank our guests, Mark Howard Sutton and Joe Bill, and everyone at Second City in the Training Center, my producer, as always, Ben Caprero, and you for listening. If you haven't gone to our Facebook page, please, please, please like Improv Nerd. It really helps my self-esteem. And for more information on me, Jimmy Carain, and my 2012 Innie Award-winning classes and workshops, go to jimmycarain.com. And check out our new website. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
It might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you